campaigns, candidates, they're great, but they build up a tent and then take it right down the day after. And I experienced that. What is so gratifying is that what I do now at America Votes, the tent never comes down. We are always keeping what we've built together, keeping the coalition together, looking backward in a strategic way, and looking forward together.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. I was very happy to have the chance to talk to Greg Speed. Greg's been leading America Votes for a decade and a half, currently serving as their president. America Votes is a coordination hub of the progressive community, connecting as many as 400 state and national partner organizations. So Greg has been a key player in the center of the progressive ecosystem for many national elections. We had a good conversation about how America Votes provides permanent infrastructure for progressive collaboration and what else he's been up to. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Greg Speed with America Votes.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from Timeplots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. Timeplots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Can I just ask you to introduce yourself and give me a quick biography?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm Greg Speed. I'm currently the president of America Votes. I am a native Midwesterner. I grew up outside of Chicago in the northern suburbs in a town called Deerfield. From there, I went to school at the great state University of Wisconsin at Madison. Got the political bug there. Actually, I've kind of really always had it all my life. Moved to Washington, D.C., moved out to do, countless number of campaigns, and have been involved in politics my entire professional life, including a tenure on Capitol Hill, at the party committees, the DCCC specifically, and I've been in America Votes as executive director first, and now in this capacity as president since, hard to believe I'm saying this, late 2007.
Yeah, that's a lot of political lifetimes, isn't it?
You said it. Three or four, at least.
What is the difference between the executive director and the president?
Mainly, the executive director really runs the show. And I spend most of my time raising money, dealing with some, the broader coalition governance. I work extremely closely with our executive director, as the predecessors in my position did with me. Sarah Schreiber is our executive director, who in other contexts might be thought of as COO, but certainly is, really runs the staff and does do work setting the direction for the organization. We as president work on, broader strategy, vision, if you will, a term I absolutely hate. But, we're a very unusual organization. We are by nature a coalition of groups committed to working together in coordination to move the ball, to win elections, and to advance progressive issues. So there's a broader nature to the work we do and the engagements that we need from leadership. And that's kind of how we walk that line. It does come down to a lot of time and energy spent raising money, as well as gauging with outside, both stakeholders within the coalition, outside stakeholders as well, with our ED, Sarah, running much of the operational work.
It strikes me as a really big challenge to coordinate a coalition. I've seen on your website, hundreds of organizations that are involved. And I know it's a challenge to, coordinate between two or three. How do you go about that?
there are a couple foundational pieces that have been present from the beginning of America Votes. I should say the organization has been in existence since 2003. The 2004 election cycle was, as you may recall, the first cycle where there just became an enormous amount of outside activity in that presidential election. And we were founded by Cecile Richards, who obviously went on to some big jobs after her tenure here. But one of the constants, when we talk about coordination, what is really important is to think about we're able to do that job because we have permanent infrastructure and a permanent infrastructure that engages partner organizations year in and year out. It is not rebuilt for every election. And so what that equates to are people. We have operations in about 20 states. The folks who convene those quote unquote tables where this work of planning and coordination takes place engage with state partner groups and national partner groups on an ongoing basis. The relationships get really deep. That's generally a good thing, but it can also be challenging, as you can imagine. And the other foundational piece of it, and you'll know, and you know, some of what you built at NGP Van is foundational to it, is data. Having a shared platform that we provide to partners along with shared data and the capacity to work with them on their programs, whether it's an election or whether it's an advocacy around their issues, those two pieces really allow us to do everything else. A permanent presence, permanent staff, focused on the coalition and focused on strategy, as well as underpinnings like data.
So how are we doing? We're going into this enormous election, really feels like sometimes the future of democracy is at stake, not just the party. There's so many people working on it. What does it look like from your vantage point? Do you think we have our act together?
Of course, I'm going to say we do, right? I have to start by saying this doesn't look like anything we've seen before. Beyond just the disruption to our daily lives, the fact that we're not out, you know, knocking doors or being, you know, at canvas launches and talking to folks who are knocking doors and just being out in the states has, you know, not being out there, you know, it does just create a pit in my stomach in and of itself. So it's just hard to gauge and hard to read. But in some ways, it also has focused us in some ways. And so we've, I think, really been able to, as an organization, and then as well as a coalition of progressive organizations working together on this election, pivot out of the field and into virtual work, and I wouldn't say seamless by any means, but in a real and significant way, and begin taking some of the things we'd been working with everyone on pre-pandemic and pre-many other crises, taking that work of targeting what's our path to victory onto virtual work, whether it's texts, phones, mail, digital, et cetera. And really also pivot on some big, big strategic priorities. The biggest one is what I call spreading out the vote. It's not focusing on just one piece of the puzzle like vote by mail. It's boosting voting in every means to be able to protect the election and have a smooth election day working back from that date, which really requires us to do more than we've ever done as a community in engaging voters about the voting process itself, starting with vote by mail and in a massive enrollment effort that we've been able to coordinate with some key progressive allies and partners on the ground and in core organizations like Voter Participation Center and CVI on the C4 side where we work with them. There have been just some really pivotal anchors that have really met the moment. And we're now in a position to be able to step back and see, as has been noted, you know, widely, some very substantial increases among the Democratic electorate in mail voting and impressive leads in some key states over the Republicans in that regard. And so we feel very good about that piece of it.
The reporting that's come to me is that the other side is canvassing and that we're not. Is that true? And how much does that worry you?
It worries me. It is true. I have more to say there in a moment. It is true. We hear reports from our states all the time about encountering Trump or Republican staff in the field. How much they're doing, I don't know. But the anecdotes are significant. They've talked about having knocked a million doors up to this point, which I believe they have. A million doors for, you know, all these months is across many states is not that great a total. We know they're out there. And by and large, our organizations and we know the Biden campaign and the Democratic Party have not been in the field. And we've heard the Biden campaign say they are not going to be in the field. So there are going to be efforts to safely conduct work in the field, door to door in some places where it can be done safely and where organizations feel they can do the work well and effectively, and they're confident in that. Certainly not pressuring anyone to do that work. But there is a strong sense that we need a presence in the field, especially as it comes down to what I was saying before, challenges like voter education with major, major changes, even predating the pandemic in states like Pennsylvania and Michigan, really wholesale changes to the voting process that are by and large good heading into this year. The need to be on turf, on doors, in real spaces and places, talking to folks about that is seen as absolutely imperative. And then we all know in some cities and in some marginalized communities, just the importance of being on doors is imperative, given the challenges of reaching voters, core parts of our coalition, reaching them through any other means but the field.
When you think back to 2016 and how you guys were prepared at this point then compared to now, how is it different?
The immediate and easy answer to that question is a stark realization of all the things that could go wrong, which, needless to say, was not as present in 2016. I would say, to go back to this point about the voting process and mail and other things, you know, relative to 16, also relative to 18, just an understanding about the importance of the process. And then in particular, the unique role, I think, of independent organizations like the community groups we work with, folks like Florida New Majority or Bloc in Milwaukee, and many, many others, in being trusted messengers, not just to validate a candidate like the Biden-Harris ticket, but to validate the process, to say it is okay to vote this way, because there is deep skepticism about that, which is why you haven't seen, even where other opportunities to vote besides Election Day haven't been as fully utilized in communities of color, for example, due to some really, you know, longstanding and understandable skepticism. So that wasn't present in 2016 for sure. A little bit of a measure of the weaknesses of our opposition. It goes without saying that we're not taking anything for granted this time. But the ability to make deep, deep inroads in, you know, suburban areas, for example, and this really connects to key priorities at the state level and in redistricting in particular. There are states where it's the very same map that we were working from back in 2016, but the possibility of winning these legislative chambers, even in states like Texas or the Florida House, are very, very present for us. And without the experience of the Trump administration driving the suburbs, and certainly it's fair to say suburban white women, away from Trump in droves, that has created, on the flip side, a real opportunity and a sense of the possible that I think is even greater than it was in 2016.
If I have a fear about this, it's that the turnout on the other side in their potential voters is off the charts. And, you know, the rural parts of the world and the conservative parts of the world just really do something that we're not expecting. Are we able to match that?
Look, I think it's a real thing. And when you think about the demographics and the path to victory in some very, very critical states, like Wisconsin, a state I know very well, or Minnesota or Michigan, you know, the demographic potential upside for Trump is there. It's possible that he could flip those states by running up that base. And they're probably, we could counteract that with work in Milwaukee, Detroit, Madison, et cetera. But there's probably more opportunity for Trump.
Non-college educated white people. Yeah.
Non-college. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Yep. And very present in a state like Wisconsin. There are a couple strong contradictory points that I think too often get underappreciated because we as progressives tend to think about that challenge and just find it so daunting. And how are we going to win these folks over? But there are a couple key points. The first I would say is pick any poll and look at the intensity underneath it. The disapproval of Donald Trump is something the likes of which we have never seen in American politics. It never moves. He is stubbornly above 50%, and that is true even in battleground states. A tick or two lower in a Wisconsin or a Pennsylvania, but not that much. And then underneath it, the intensity of opposition is much stronger than the intensity of support. So they really have, now they're doing everything to get their folks back, but they're, you know, they have softer support than we do. And it tends to get reported the other way, that Trump voters are enthusiastic and Biden aren't. But Trump is the defining figure in this election. This is a referendum on him, and we should want it to be. And the intensity of opposition is far greater than the intensity of support. And that extends into the quote-unquote Trump base of non-college white educated voters. They are not all just primed to be waiting for racist appeals. There are a whole lot of other issues important to that electorate, to say nothing of what it does in our ability to mobilize our base, the progressive base. The other quick point I'll make, and I spoke quite a bit on that one, is just if you were to step back and think just big picture demographics and set everything else aside, but you were asked whether you're going to run a major political party in this country and you would want to have the challenge of running up the vote as much as conceivable in rural America, which is shrinking, or conversely offend the rest of the country, the suburban and urban areas that are diversifying and growing, even in the Trump era, even in this awful recession. What would you pick? I mean, where would you bet the future of your party on? Demographics aren't destiny, but man, did they make a strange decision on what they've done here.
Managing this coalition, you have issue groups and you have, I mean, all kinds of different parts of the coalition, groups that are very broad, groups that are very narrow, different geographies. What are the biggest challenges in managing a coalition like that to a common goal?
Oftentimes, in the pre-Trump era, it was setting the common goal. And by that, I mean, I've been in the job long enough to know when there were still good, you know, pro-labor Republicans in state legislatures who were, you know, awful on, you know, reproductive freedom or the environment. And so setting those common goals should be challenging. You know, unfortunately, the awfulness of our opposition is in some ways made it easier. I think the biggest challenge is just trying to, like, you know, continue to be a place where organizations of an incredibly diverse range of interests and models and organizing and the ways they think about power and building it feel some stake in agency in coming to the table. And so the ways we do that are, you know, obviously getting aligned on the big picture goals and, you know, defeating Donald Trump is an easy one this time. But it's kind of meeting groups where they're at, providing service, not always focusing on how we're trimming this margin or growing this one here or there, but being, you know, a real organization that groups, including many that are, you know, very different from my background and focused on building power in marginalized communities, actually, you know, feel comfortable sitting across with some very political organizations and creating that space that is meaningful and value add to everyone is something I think we've done pretty well, but it is very challenging. It is something we have to constantly challenge ourselves in.
You mentioned that you're working with these groups like Block and Florida New Majority, and that strikes me, and maybe you indicated this, that it's a pretty new development to have that kind of focus. And I've heard that around and about with a lot of people, that we've moved some distance towards the kind of organizations that are working all year round, that are not just coming in at election time, that are run by locals. Is that new? How important is it?
Oh, I think it's hugely important, and it is new, at least our ability to work with organizations at greater scale and maintain it in a year-round basis. We mentioned those groups like there's obviously, as you know, a whole host of organizing networks and other state-based groups like Make the Road or CASA in Pennsylvania. What's new is the ability to work at greater scale year in, year out. I would not, you know, gloss over the fact that much of that has come from the funding community and elements that are squarely focused on defeating Trump and view that as a means. So I think our challenge, once we accomplish that task, is how we keep it up, how we keep, you know, growing these capacities and allowing the organizations to be real and focus on the things they want to focus on while continuing to work in coalition, contributing to the win. But the short answer to your question is the growth of strong community-based organizations engaged in organizing in elections has grown tremendously in the last 4 or 5 years.
Broadly, in this run-up to the election, what are your biggest concerns and what is giving you the most cause for optimism?
I would say concern-wise, you know, it is, I hate to be obvious, but it's hard not to be here. It is complacency creeping in and not keeping our eye on the ball on the absolute fundamentals that have to come together and some of the challenges that will be there, as I've talked about with regard to the voting process, the incredible, you know, nefarious nature of the Trump campaign and allies and throwing everything, including the kitchen sink, at trying to suppress votes. You know, finding a allied federal judge in this state or that and gumming up the works. And, you know, sowing chaos as, you know, luckily there's so much focus on. In some ways, I think Trump, you know, showed his cards too early on being such a bad actor when it comes to the election. But then again, we've seen it from day one with him. But that's my greatest concern. Maybe my greatest sense of optimism is how focused we are on it. Nobody has to be told in my organization, coalition, or I think the broader community that this could really happen and we have to mobilize to stop it from happening. And then a bit more optimistically is just the enormous potential in two regards: to win a sweeping win, not just at the White House level, but down ballot, down to the legislatures, down to local levels that matter so much. And then, you know, maybe coming out of this, and this is a big maybe, but some sense of the importance of this civic engagement. And back to your point about the groups and what we've built there, you know, what that is ultimately about is civic engagement. It's about engaging communities in civic life, voting being one part of it. And I think, you know, maybe if there are cleansing effects from this guy, and God, you know, hopefully there will be a greater understanding of the importance of civics, civic life, civic engagement, and voting, 2020 being the really the launch of that. I guess hard to, you know, have a greater optimism for that and hard to see it sometimes in the morass we're in day to day, but I don't think it's pie in the sky. I don't think it's Pollyannish. I think it's possible.
I heard some hair-raising stories after 2016 about our canvassing in the last couple weeks, or a lot of people were doing this plan to vote stuff, and they weren't taking the opportunity to argue when, say, the Comey letter comes out. There wasn't people sort of helping to explain that situation or turn it to our advantage. Do we have the capability when Trump pulls surprises, when a Durham thing comes out in October, or, you know, do we have the ability to argue at the last minute with our field operation, or what it is now with text, phones, mail, digital, all that?
I remember that so distinctly, having those conversations on doors myself and, you know, really feeling in the moment some of the shortcomings of, you know, this sort of petri dish script of plan to vote. Will you do this, that, or the other thing? I think we all recognize a greater need to leverage the conversation. What I mean by that is how you account for, you get someone at the door, that is an enormous opportunity. And just because the science and testing says plan to vote in an entirely different context lifted points that much, we cannot just content ourselves to say, well, that's the best, highest use of this conversation. There are still elements of that that we think work and are effective and you will see in scripts, but there's a major understanding that we have to say a bit more and frankly provide information. Plan to vote was all about a behavioral trick of getting people to think about going through the process and then it being more likely to turn them out. Now we've got a lot to say to them about the process itself that we need to be delivering, dropping, putting in their hands. You know, to the extent we're going to be on doors this year. I know what you're saying. I don't think we've fully corrected from it. There's still a lot of, you know, ultimately these things should be a balance of art and science, right? And there's still a lot of science.
And we still need to be campaigning, it feels like to me, at the end, because the guy we're up against has this ability to inject something into everybody's mind with a couple tweets. And, you know, the media amplifies that, and we have to be able to talk back. You know, it seems one-on-one and more broadly. Although, you know, he can't move people that much. I mean, I understand it's complicated.
If we get out our vote in a free and fair election that is, able to be conducted as it should be, we don't have to change a mind. I hate to say that, but it's true. Not that we shouldn't try, but we need to. Opinion's hard to move now. This was a very different context in 16 than it is now. I think the point holds up. The need potentially to have to address whatever they're throwing here. But I think we've really got to be careful in how much we want to feed into their narrative, which so many people have tuned out, and not overestimate their ability to, you know, change hearts and minds at this point. And the simplicity of the response, which I think we've seen from Biden in a very effective way. It's pretty simple. People believe he's a liar. So,
or our side does.
Yeah, our side and more.
And that might be the lesson of their convention, that, you know, you could watch it and you could see why some people might hear it effectively, even though it was incredibly misleading in so many aspects. But then it didn't move that many people or didn't change his favorables much or all those things.
That's right. I think you're putting your finger on one of the great tragedies of 16. I mean, I think your analysis of that and what you've been hearing is accurate. We did not, because at that point in time, we thought, look, this would be enough. We don't have to push back. I'm not sure what the right mix is now.
But like if that Comey thing moved 2 points nationally or something like that, then, you know, we had to get that back. And there's going to be something he does again that is going to have, you know, not that he orchestrated that exactly, but there's something may happen. We can't have the last.
Well, they're certainly going to try.
Yeah, of course. Greg, I've never been part of one of these, what you're calling conversations, the tables in the States, or what you really are more broadly. What is a meeting like? What do people talk about? What is agenda? How does that kind of go? To the extent you can share it.
I recommend them to many. They're not held in that big of rooms. So, you know, we don't advertise. They're remarkable things because they are tables. You know, these are groups across the spectrum kind of coming together. And, you know, for a whole lot of every 2 years cycle, you know, there's always obviously some discussion of the campaign and data and what's going on in the landscape and analysis of what just happened. A lot of it is about issues, about the day jobs of these organizations, most of which are issue organizations or membership organizations. Campaigns are, you know, a means to an end for most of them. We don't take positions on issues other than voting and democracy. But we certainly make the table open for discussion of what's happening in legislatures or with various advocacy campaigns and opportunities for groups to partner in that work, even though, you know, our role may be very light or just facilitating that cross-table discussion. You know, a lot of it is community. You know, when I go into some of these states, I've been doing this a while, I know a lot of the partner groups and I've known them for over a decade. and those folks in state know each other very well. And, you know, some leave their positions, some move into government. And it's a, you know, it's what it means to be building a progressive, not just a progressive infrastructure, but a progressive community. I don't get out to those meetings nearly enough.
What are the characteristics of a well-run table? What do you look for in someone leading that or making it most effective?
Leadership and the ability to build consensus around a strategy, but then an understanding of, you know, what comes to that table, and then what's our role in moving conversations that may not be appropriate for that table, but that we should be leaders in facilitating, creating space either at the table to do what I was just saying, which is report out to the whole to try to build outside of the whole, or sometimes helping facilitate that more directly. My predecessor, Joan Fitzgerald, from Colorado, former Senate leader there, gave to me the best description of some of our state leaders, which is an America Votes state director is a combination of Mother Teresa and Joan of Arc rolled into one.
Hard to find someone with that.
It is. Two of our longest serving staff both have masters in social work. That tells you what it takes.
A lot of times the media sees our party in terms of this moderate progressive split, you know, the Sanders-Clinton split or whatever it was. Do you see that in your work, or is that less relevant?
Do we see it? Certainly. As I said before, it has been less relevant in recent years, again, due to the, you know, focus on nationally on Trump and winning back power in Congress, and in the states, really building back majorities there. But we're in power in a lot of states now, and we're beginning to see some of those elements and real divisions within our allies in some states that have power. And I view that as extremely healthy. It has been all too easy for an organization with our mission to keep everyone at the table for the last, you know, 10 to 15 years. It will be a mark of progress if we are encountering more challenges with that. It means we're winning. And it means folks have different definitions of what we do with that power. That's great. We are, the challenge for us is how we keep everyone there, how we do what we do, but be real and support folks in a way that is meaningful to them. I hope we're having, you know, if we're talking in a couple of years, talking about the greater challenges we're having with that.
Yeah, that makes sense. One of the things you mentioned is providing data tools to your partners. Have they held up in the need to pivot to virtual? Are you adding things? Do you feel like you're well served by technology and data now, or what are the biggest gaps if you're not?
Yeah, should I break out my litany of you know, van wants and needs and complaints?
Well, I'm not part of that anymore, but yeah,
I know, I'm kidding.
You can if you want.
I'm kidding. Well, that tool's held up very well, and the fact that we you know, have rely on it to the extent we do is really a measure of how well it, and when we have challenges, it is a big one, and is a measure of how effective it's been. We've had longstanding challenges, especially as an organization focusing on coordination and how we are engaging voters at the individual level. It's been a huge priority for us for many election cycles now to bring greater integration in field, terrestrial, you know, bringing that kind of coordination into the digital space. It has really forced us to make it a greater priority in this cycle. There have been some strides in good mapping and integration of other tools. There's a ton more that needs to be done that we're not even going to get close to making progress on in this cycle, but I think we've pinpointed some of the real pressure points of where we really need to get real, and just kind of how we think with AV, it's challenging because we are always trying to aggregate and coordinate. And so much of the innovation has been in, you know, building a better, you know, tool for this marginal benefit over here. You know, that can live in harmony, but I think we really do need to get better about the ways we think about targeting in the virtual space across the board. Some progress on things like relational tools and really getting some idea of what that contact looks like. But we're not going to be where we'd like to be on some other fronts. And being able to target and match to voter file, which is always perennially going to be a challenge on some of the other virtual fronts.
I can't imagine you didn't see this report out of Hawkfish about the red mirage that might happen, where it appears on election night that Trump is way ahead because we are doing more voting by mail on our side. I'm just curious about vote by mail generally. What is the strategy on that, and what are you guys up to get the most out of it, but protect against things like that kind of mirage?
Yeah, I'm familiar with that. It's a real dynamic, but there are a couple major counterpoints, I think, and then some priorities for all of us right now. One is there are states such as Florida and Arizona that will be pre-counting for weeks, at least in the case of Florida, I know, for weeks leading into the election. And so that count is going to come very fast. Now, if it's a close election in Florida and we're waiting in all the other states, that could begin to kick in that dynamic. But if Biden is winning by a healthy margin, we'll know it in Florida and in Arizona pretty quick, with pretty high degree of confidence, maybe even election night. And that will, you know, that may not be 270, but that will, I think, really just create a whole different dynamic in how we're waiting for counts in other states. There are efforts, Governor Wolf in Pennsylvania, Jocelyn Benson, Secretary of State in Michigan, are working to try to bring pre-counting into those states. It may require legislative action. That's not entirely sure right now, or at least I'm not. But so there's a broad understanding of the need to really have a quicker count. And candidly, I'm obviously incredibly supportive of greater use of early vote, and vote by mail. But I would say that, and we want ballots to come in that are postmarked, and if they come in days after the election, they should be counted. If they were cast on election day. I think what folks have in mind are states like California, where the count has dragged on for weeks and weeks. And I would suggest that California should begin to engage in greater pre-counting and just try to find ways to speed up the count, because while they're doing the right thing in counting every vote, on the flip side, we have a very nefarious Republican Party and President Trump who spin conspiracy theories where there are none. And we saw it even in 2018 as Dems continued flipping blue seats in California. I do think we have to find ways to speed up the vote count as well. And we need networks to be responsible and the media to be responsible about the way they cover things. I think there's a better emphasis on not using precinct counts. You may notice that you don't see that as much on some of the TV coverage, because that's not really an accurate reflection of what the vote is, and folks don't understand that. But we really need, and there are some efforts to really educate newsrooms between now and November 3rd about what to expect.
Do you think we can win Florida? We always seem to have disappointment there.
I believe we can win Florida, yes. I think it is. I've been an advocate for Florida throughout this entire cycle, even after the bitter experience of 2018. And I think we can do it by engaging the growing communities of color in the state and the Puerto Rican community in Central Florida. Trump may be doing a little better with the Cuban community, but he is not doing as well among seniors, which, as has been indicated in the polls, creates a real path, more than a real path, the strong prospect of a Biden win if he can maintain that. And if you really look at where we've fallen short in Florida, a state that I've done a lot of work in and have looked closely at, it has been, we've met our numbers cycle after cycle, which is why it's so frustrating that we keep coming up a 0.5% short. But it's been in the non-urban I-4 corridor. So places like Brevard and Flagler counties and, you know, not the suburban I-4, but a layer outside, that we have just lost by greater and greater margins election after election. And those are some of the hardest places hit economically in Florida right now. And I would not be surprised if we can, you know, not make up a ton of ground, but certainly stem the bleeding, if not do even better in that particular part of the state. And if that part of the state stays where it has been historically, which is Republican, but not overwhelmingly so, Florida can get bluer and bluer over time.
What else would you want people to know about America Votes and what it's up to right now?
We, along with our partners, have really, in a very genuine way, really gotten the message on the need to continually focus on voting rights, which is, you know, apart from the coordination and convening, part of our work is a significant body of work for us in several states, engaging legislators, election administrators from our 501c4. That is among the most critical work we do. And I think the broader community has understood that by taking our ball off the structural elements of our challenges explains a lot about how things have gotten as bad as they have in the country. To summarize, the strong focus on voting rights with a number of allied groups, some phenomenal groups like Fair Fight, Stacey Abrams Group, Leadership Conference under Vinita Gupta is just phenomenal. There's so much energy in that space, and we're contributing just a bit, but we're really pleased to do that work, and we do it year in, year out. And that extends to a lot of our coalition partners, many who main focus maybe their union members or the environment. All of us have really become just so much more focused on voting rights and structural democracy reform. And so I'd lift that up.
Do you mind if I ask you just a couple more questions about your biography? Because I think people ought to know the path that it takes to get to a prominent leadership position in the progressive ecosystem here, as you are. You said that you kind of got the political bug at Madison, but actually maybe you had it all along. Was it a political family that you grew up in? How did you contract that bug?
No. Recovering Republicans these days, but no, they were not, meaning they're with us now, but not all of them always. But I grew up outside of Chicago, as I said, in Deerfield, which has historically kind of been the bastion of Rockefeller Republicanism in Illinois, or maybe in Illinois terms, Charles Percy Republican Party. You know, it goes right back to the age of 13. I was an avid news consumer from a very, very young age, and just began to really understand the importance of politics and the differences between leaders and between parties. And I talk about this a fair amount when I talk to younger groups, and that it all, for me, the defining moment was actually in the Reagan administration and his veto of the South African sanctions bill, the apartheid government in South Africa. And that veto was actually overridden. But I could not believe that President Reagan, who I'm pretty certain my parents supported and most of their friends and most in my town, would take that stand, would prevent this country from taking that stand against apartheid. It was very clear who was on what side. I associated with the Democratic Party from that moment on. It's worth noting that a lot of Republicans made that override of the veto possible. So there were, you know, once reasonable Republicans within my lifetime. But that became defining and really spoke to my sense of, you know, the importance of racial justice and the way I viewed the world and equity. And as I got older, reproductive justice. And it was just as clear who was on what side on that. And as I went to Wisconsin and really got in campaigns there and began engaging with the labor movement, for example, for the first time, not a big thing in, you know, the North Shore of Illinois, or at least not in my circles, but, you know, getting to work with union leaders in the 1992 election and then having that incredible win, just really getting a taste for not just the politics and campaigns and winning, but the people behind it, the movements behind it, the work they did in their organizations. And that really did kind of lead me, you know, many, many years later to America Votes. I did most of my work in politics prior to this and the party at the House DCCC and at the House Democratic Caucus and working with the chair, Martin Frost from Texas. I compare what I'm doing in this role with my experience back in 92. After that election, I became the co-chair with a friend of mine of the College Democrats. And we went from having thousands of student volunteers on the Madison campus to not being able to recruit a soul to turn out for anything in support of President Clinton's agenda. I got the absolute sense of what I talk about a lot, which are campaigns, candidates, they're great, but they build up a tent and then take it right down the day after. And I experienced that. And when I did that particular role after 1992, what is so gratifying is that what I do now at America Votes, the tent never comes down. We are always keeping what we've built together, keeping the coalition together, looking backward in a strategic way, and looking forward together. I really view that as kind of the bookend of my experience in politics and why I'm really encouraged about where we're going as a party and as a movement. Because I will say the Democratic Party has gotten much better about building this infrastructure and working with outside allies in the time I've been here in this role.
As you came up through that system, were there progressive leaders, and I don't mean elected ones, but people who did jobs like you do that you admired and learned from?
You know, prior to coming to this work, I would answer that with some of my experience in campaigns, work I did with, you know, these are not nationally known folks. These are folks like Ron Dominey. I'm going to mention two people with AFSCME, actually, just to both came to the top of mind here. Ron Dominey in Wisconsin, who is a major force in state politics, and someone who was a huge deal I didn't even realize as I got to know him. And then Dee Simpson in Texas, who I got to know quite well through my boss's races in North Texas and work I did in East Texas on a state Senate election, and kept popping up everywhere. And it was just really remarkable to me that there were folks who were so attuned to their organizations and their missions. You know, that's what they did most of the time, but they were some of the smartest political minds I'd ever encountered. That they were doing that work, but being so involved in campaigns was really mind-blowing to me. And very much, I think, kind of the place at which this organization sits, or where I've tried to get it to be and hopefully keep it in this space. So those are some examples from before I came to America Votes. But I won't even try to begin saying the state leaders I would lift up in that regard now. There are so many. And to your point earlier about the growth in community organizing, just the leadership that we, not America Votes, but we as a community have been able to cultivate in states over the last decade is really remarkable. I think we're proud of our small contribution too, but I think all Democrats and progressives need to understand and appreciate.
If a person came to you as taking the helm of one of our important organizations, what advice would you give them about how you run such an entity?
Well, I think back to my time here. When I came to America Votes, I took leave from the consulting firm that I was working with at the time. And it took me about 2 months to realize, maybe not that long, maybe a month, I could not do the job without ending my leave and committing to the long haul. And so how I would apply that to someone coming in to run a progressive organization is, come in with, you know, energy and ideas and an agenda, but don't try to implement it until you know the organization and its culture, and check your assumptions about what it is you've gotten into. It may be exactly what you thought it was, or it may be slightly different. Be humble, be ambitious, but be humble a bit. And use that period of time coming in to really focus on the culture of the organization as well as its mission. Because if I had gone on the path that I had assumed I was, I would have essentially been a short timer. Word would have got out about that. And I would have had no ability to lead. Now, that's an extreme example compared to what I said. I didn't quite understand the culture of the organization and how my agenda would have affected my ability to implement it, my situation, I should say. You've got to get your feet wet in an organization while not checking your ambition. I mean, we did some ambitious things, expanding into a bunch of new states within the first 3 or 4 months of, you know, we did a ton. But man, I wish I'd, you know, not thought I sort of knew everything I needed to know about what I'd just gotten into, which in retrospect kind of sounds kind of naive, but I think I do see a lot of leaders do it, sometimes unconsciously.
How would you characterize the culture of America Votes now?
We've been collegial from the start. It takes a certain mix and certain kind of folk, or at least it has historically, to come here and to want to work here. We've been, I think, making strides on being more inclusive and equitable. Certainly raising it as a priority for the organization in what I think our team would agree is a meaningful way. Our goal, and we've been very successful in this, is to bring folks in and build them and keep them for a long, you know, period of time. You know, that's consistent with our mission as a permanent campaign infrastructure. One of our challenges has been just how, given our mission, given our capacity, how to grow folks up a ladder in this position. You tend to come in, or in this organization, you tend to come in at one rung, and it's hard to move to the next. I think we're making progress, and you know, I'd say the simple way I'd put it is we're collegial and very goal-driven at the same time, and manage to maintain that mix and hopefully make this a welcoming and inclusive work environment. I think we've made strides on that front in recent years, and I really credit our executive director, Sarah Schreiber, with an enormous amount of progress on that work.
Craig, is there a question that I have failed to ask that you'd like to answer?
I mean, I don't think so, Nathaniel.
Okay.
These have been great questions.
Thank you. Should you be in all 50 states? Why only 20?
It's been a matter of a little bit of mission and you know, are we, you know, matched to the battleground and winning, you know, nationally, or are we more mission, which is certainly there are elements of our mission that every state, you know, the community could benefit from and every state could benefit from for our being in all 50. The short answer is why we're not is really been capacity. And I think just the having not just the financial capacity, but the capacity to have folks in leadership to really step back and think about what that would look like before heading into the next election cycle. Because, man, being a Chicago native and spending a lot of time in New York and California these days, you know, certainly there could be some America Votes presence there, but it would look a lot different than what it might look like in Florida or Wisconsin or Arizona. So it's having the money and the space to really build it out. But I get that question a lot. And that was a good one. Maybe that's how I should have answered that.
Well, Greg, it's been really an honor to talk to you today. Anything else you want to say?
I don't think so. It's been an honor to speak with you. Thank you. For a great conversation and for asking me to do it. I'm really, really pleased that you did. And for this contribution to engaging in this work and sharing information in the community, this is an impressive thing you've built. You've had some great, great folks on in the time you've been doing it. And I'm really, really pleased that you asked me to join you. Thank you.
Thanks. That was Greg Speed. He's at americavotes.org. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.